In the last couple of years, my wife and I have been very well educated in marriage customs. We married one boy off in 2004 and then married the other son off in 2005. And we've learned more about weddings and wedding traditions than, frankly, we ever thought we needed to know. That says there should be a picture of a bride and groom right there. And I have a bad feeling I have put the wrong file onto this computer. We have noted a number of wedding traditions. Of course, you're familiar with a lot of the things that go on in weddings. Bridesmaids, groomsmen, father walks in the bride, bride's usually dressed in white. There's an exchange of vows typically in the ceremony, flowers and corsages, the exchange of rings, the throwing of rice, I guess now it's bird seed instead of rice, the throwing of the bride's garter to the men and the throwing of the bride's corsage to the women, the lighting of candles in the course of the ceremony. We've developed a lot of different traditions that you would recognize, of course, in what we would know as a wedding ceremony. I did a little bit of research about wedding ceremonies and found some interesting things. You might enjoy some of these different traditions. Wedding ceremonies vary different, very greatly depending on the time and the place that you're talking about. In ancient Roman weddings, rather than rice, what they would do is they'd break a loaf of wheat bread over the heads of the bride and the groom. I think the idea is you break it over them, not over their heads. But I'm not real sure about that. If you break it over their heads, maybe you just need to make sure it wasn't cooked too much. But the idea is that it was to ensure a fertile and fulfilling life. Wheat, bread, that was the staff of life. That's what sustained individuals. And the guests got the crumbs. They ate the crumbs for good luck. Italians have interesting wedding customs. For instance, in Italian weddings, the best man of the groom, in the course of the festivities, will take the tie of the groom and cut it into little pieces. And then the guests at the wedding get to buy the pieces of that tie, and then the money goes to the bride and the groom. I've got several ties that I wouldn't mind donating to that kind of a custom. You got to be careful which tie you wear to your wedding. It's going to go up in little pieces. They have another interesting custom. They break a vase, the bride and the groom do in these Italian weddings, and the number of pieces that the vase breaks into is supposed to indicate how many years that they're going to be married. I read another source that said how many children they're going to have. You're kind of in a quandary, aren't you? You want to be married a long time, so you want a lot of pieces, but what if it's children instead of years? You could be blessed far beyond your means. Chinese weddings do not typically use white as the dominant color. They use red rather than we do, as we do, white. Red represents joy to them. The groom does much as biblical weddings would suggest. He goes and to the bride at her home. And he is going to bring her from her home back to the wedding location in a veiled bridal chair that's borne by attendants, carried by attendants. But it's bad luck for the bride's feet to touch the ground from her house to his house. And so they've got a special person called a dajin. I'm not sure if that's the correct pronunciation, D-A-J-I-N. And it's a woman whose job is to get the bride and carry her on her back to the chair and then out of the chair into the groom's house. Apparently, She'd have to be maybe a pretty stout woman in some cases, but that's her job. She basically carries the bride on her back to the chair so that her feet don't touch the ground. Well, we can just go on and on. A lot of interesting customs that develop in various cultures and times. But one thing that is sure, and that is that Bible weddings were different than our weddings. In biblical times, the wedding consisted more of the groom going and getting his bride from her father's house in most cases, and bringing her back to his own house. If you've got your New Testaments, you might wish to open to Matthew the 25th chapter, and I want you to know I am so disappointed. I had some of the best slides I've done in a long time. And I apparently put the wrong file, the incomplete slide file, up here on the computer. And so I'm not going to get to use my slides. And I'm carrying this changer around. I'm not sure why now. Because I don't have anything to change. But Matthew 25 is one of two parables that we're going to look at. And the first parable here, Matthew 25, verses 1 through 13, is a story of a wedding. And it incorporates some of the customs of biblical weddings. For instance, we learned in verse 1 that the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. The bridegroom would go, typically in the evening, from his own home over to the bride's place of residence, probably her father's house. And since this was in the evening, his guests, the invited guests to the wedding, would either wait along the way from the bride's house back to the groom's house, or they'd wait at the groom's house. And they'd bring lamps. Of course, back in those days, they didn't have street lamps. So if you were out in the evening and you needed to see, you had to have your little oil, your olive oil lamp, probably just kind of a dish with a wick out the side. And so the text goes on to describe some of these customs. The groom, once he goes to the bride's house, then he conducts her back to his own house. A very fitting ceremony, if you ask me. And a lot cheaper than some of the ones that we pay for. It makes good sense, doesn't it, that kind of a ceremony? Because what does the Bible say in Genesis 2 about this business of being married? It is that these two leave and cleave. They leave father and mother. She's starting a new life with a husband. She's starting a new relationship, a one-flesh relationship that takes priority over the relationship she's had with her parents. And he likewise is doing the same thing. Genesis 2:24 is specifically addressed to him, that is, the husband. And so he conducts her back to his own house, where theoretically his guests are waiting. Some of them perhaps join the wedding party on the way, and they've got their lamps. Now, when they get back there, then the couple will host a feast that might last in some cases for days. That's where the real cost of the wedding comes in. Back in Judges, in chapter 14, we find out that in Samson's wedding, it was a 7-day feast. And there were apparently a lot of guests that had been invited. And you read in other places in the Scriptures about these wedding customs. But I'd like to continue our reading in Matthew chapter 25, beginning in verse 2. 10 virgins were told who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now 5 of them were wise and 5 were foolish. Those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. But while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight, a cry was heard, "Behold, the bridegroom is coming. Go out to meet him." Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answered, saying, "No, lest there should not be enough for us and you. But go rather to those who sell and buy for yourselves." And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came. And those who were ready went in with him to the wedding. And the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore," Jesus concludes, "for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming." And so two groups of virgins, 5 on either side, the wise and the foolish. And the wise brought their lamps, their oil lamps, but so did the foolish. And the wise brought oil for their lamps, but so did the foolish. And they were both waiting for the bridegroom, both groups. What distinguishes the groups into wise and foolish is that the wise had made preparation to wait for an extensive period of time, to anticipate the fact that the bridegroom might delay even until midnight. You think, well, why did he take so long? He may have been greeting people on the way. There may have been some sort of festivities or greetings or conversation at the bride's house. We don't know. That's not the point. The point is they needed to be continually ready, and the foolish were not. Perseverance is necessary, I think, is a key message of the parable. We don't know the time of the coming of the Lord. In my opinion, Matthew 24 is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem the entire chapter. You may not agree with that, but that's my opinion. I do believe, however, that chapter 25 moves to a different topic, that we begin talking about the final coming of Jesus. And we don't know when that's going to be. We don't know the day nor the hour. And I will tell you, that's the real difficulty of being a Christian. Is it not? This business of being faithful day after day after day, continuing to be ready. Oh, it's easy to be good, to do the right things, to be faithful and to persevere for a short period of time. But I know for a fact that some of you have been Christians for decades now. You've been waiting perhaps most of your life already, in the case of some of us who are older, waiting for the Lord. And you need to be ready just as badly today as you did when the day that you were baptized. There needs to be no let up, but that's the difficulty. It's easy to be faithful and to do the great thing for Jesus Christ on one day if the next day means glory. Much harder to persevere day after day, to make the countless decisions that have to be made in order to serve Jesus Christ faithfully. You got to take that oil, that extra oil, so that you're ready no matter how long the bridegroom delays. It might be that he may not return before our death. And so we need to be faithful until the time that we cross the Jordan. The foolish virgins could not borrow oil from the wise virgins. One of the things that I read that was kind of interesting, and many of you are probably already aware of this, and that is that olive oil was what was used in the lamps typically in the first century and even prior to that. And olive oil, most of the time in Palestine, was abundantly available. It wasn't a scarce commodity, or for that matter, a particularly expensive commodity. And so typically in a Jewish home, a lamp would be left burning all the time. You just replenished the olive oil from time to time, and perhaps the wick as it sat in the oil. It's not a question of the unavailability of oil. It's a lack of planning. But the point made in the parable is that everyone has to make their own preparation. The foolish could not depend upon the wise to have brought enough oil both for themselves and for the foolish virgins. And so it is with us. Each of us must make our own preparations for the Lord's return. Those who are unprepared, when the bridegroom arrives, miss the opportunity to enjoy the wedding feast. The most sobering words in this parable are, "And the door was shut." End of opportunity. No more opportunity. When the bridegroom comes, that's it. You're either ready or you're not ready, but there's no more opportunity to enter into the feast. What's the application for us? There are a lot of people that I have known over the years, good friends even that I have now in some cases, that if I could, I would make their preparations for them. And there are people like that in your life too, I'm sure. People that you're fairly confident because you know something of their lives or perhaps of their heart from their actions, you know that they're not prepared. They're not ready for the Lord. And because you love them and you care about them, you would like to make their preparations for them if you could. But you can't. That's an individual responsibility. And you can't prepare for me and I can't prepare for you. Each of us has to make our own preparations. Regardless of how much I might want to help somebody else, they have to decide whether they're going to be obedient to the Lord or not. They have to decide whether they're going to live morally or not. They have to decide whether they're going to seek forgiveness of sins or not. And frankly, there's nothing I can do about their decision. Once it's made, it's their responsibility. Ultimately, they must make their own preparations. Now I want you to look briefly at the other parable in Luke, the 12th chapter, the one that Gary read. I appreciate his fine reading this morning. It is a parable, the story of a rich farmer. I asked Gary to begin reading actually in verse 13, because in order to appreciate the parable, you have to know the background of the parable, and that really begins at least in verse 13, where Jesus is asked by somebody in the crowd to be an arbitrator, to tell his brother to divide the inheritance with him. And Jesus says in verse 15 that these people assembled there needed to take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. And the parable is connected to that warning. This is a parable about covetousness. Now I tell you, it's an interesting parable because what happens in the story is that you've got a farmer who does well. That may be a miracle for a farmer to do well, but it's not a sin. After all, it's God who sends the rain and God who causes the sun to shine. It's God who brings the crops. Don't fault the farmer because he did well. That's not the problem. The word that is used here for covetousness in the Greek language is a word that literally means greediness or avarice. It is the desire to have more. But the interesting thing about this farmer is that he didn't want what the neighbor farmer had. He wasn't interested in taking from somebody else that which did not belong to him. That is, in typical fashion as we think about it, his problem was he wanted to keep what he had for himself. Selfishness. Greediness in that respect. But Jesus introduces an element into this story that fits rather well with the points that we're making this morning about preparation. As this farmer, in his egotistical fashion, says, I have crops. I will build bigger barns. I will save to myself. And God says, fool. Because you don't even have a tomorrow. Many years I'm going to enjoy all of these things. His arrogance and his selfishness is evident in his planning. And Jesus says in the end, so is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. That's the application of the parable. But the interesting element of the parable that Jesus introduces is, you don't have time for further preparations. Tonight, it's over. And this particular story illustrates the same point that James made in the 4th chapter of his epistle. And that is that we don't know when it is that we need to be ready from the standpoint of when Jesus will return. You can't guess, I'm going to live my life for a while the way I want to live it, and then at some point I'll straighten everything up and I'll get right with God and sneak in right under the wire. Right before the Lord comes. Because we just don't know. We don't know either when the Lord's going to come, nor when our lives will end. And that was the mistake of the rich fool. He didn't know that his time was up. He didn't know what time it was. In James, the 4th chapter, James writes about our lives and the arrogance of assuming that our lives will go on and on. He says in chapter 4 of James and verse 13, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit. Whereas, you do not know what will happen tomorrow. How many of you have already made plans for tomorrow? I have. I don't think there's anything evil about making plans for the future. In fact, you'll find yourself in a heap of trouble if you don't make some plans for the future, even the long-term future. But in the midst of all that planning, James says, for what is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. James says, your problem is you are boasting in what you are doing. You are assuming you have a tomorrow. The Brazilians have a habit, the Christians down there do. They'll say this over and over again. Se Deus quiser, if God wishes. They take this passage and they use it in a literal fashion. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not sure that's what James is getting at. I don't know that James expects that every time we talk about what we're going to do tomorrow or sometime in the future, we should say, if the Lord wills. I believe what he's saying is that as we make these plans, we need to keep in mind that it's God who determines whether we have it tomorrow or not. And that frankly, it is arrogant for us to assume that we can control our future. We can't. We can make plans. But sometimes our souls are required tonight, not tomorrow, or the next day, or even further off into the future. This story by Jesus introducing that one element suggests that not only do we have to make our own preparations, but we always have to be ready. Because we just don't know when those preparations will be required. Well, you've been very patient, even with the non-existent charts. Let me conclude this morning by saying the parable of the 10 virgins suggests the need to be prepared for the final coming of Jesus. But not only that, it suggests that no one else can make your preparations. You're either prepared this morning or you're not. And it's really up to you. I'm sure there are brethren here who would love to see others in this assembly obey the gospel or make themselves right with God. And we'll encourage you in just a few moments by the singing of a song and an invitation to obey God. But you must make the decision. You have to take the step and then the next step and make yourself right with God. The parable of the rich farmer says, you need to be ready today. All the time. In Matthew 25 and verse 10, the bridegroom arrives, and those that have got their lamps and they're ready, they're waiting for the bridegroom, they go into the wedding feast, and the door was shut. But I'll tell you, today, the door's still open. The opportunity still exists for you to become right with God, to be forgiven of your sins, but you need to seize the opportunity while you still have the opportunity to do so. Morning, noon, or night, Jesus could come anytime. The question is, are you prepared to meet your God? If you're not a Christian, I don't want to be brutal, but you're not prepared. You're in the same condition as those people that Paul wrote about in Ephesians, the 2nd chapter. He said they were without hope. Said they were without God in the world. There they are, dead in their sins, stained with all of the disobedience and all the selfishness, all the evil thoughts, all the terrible things that sometimes people do. There they were, in that mire. But the blood of Jesus Christ can cleanse us. If we'll submit to Him, believe in Him as the Son of God, and confess our faith in Him, with our tongues, as Romans 10, verses 9 and 10 suggests we must. And we can be baptized, buried with Him into death, and then rise to walk in a new life, a new spiritual life, even as He arose from the grave. And the power of God that raised Jesus from the dead, Colossians 2:12 says, will raise us spiritually, having been forgiven of all of our sins. This morning, if you're not a Christian, why not get ready this morning? Why not be prepared before you leave this place? So that if the Lord comes before we meet again this evening, you're ready. If we can assist you in any way, this morning as we stand and sing, we invite you, if you'll come to the front, we'll assist you. Won't you come as we stand and sing?